Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001, The Scorpion and the Frog.
Hello, I was a guest on the Bob Grant Show in New York last week. Bob Grant's talk radio show is enormously popular with his white male audience, despite his rough treatment of some of his guests and many of his callers. A typical comment to a caller who displeases him is, "Get off the line, you jerk!" He once told a black welfare mother, "If I ever get hold of you, I'll give you a tubal ligation with my bare hands." As I said, comments of this sort make Bob Grant enormously popular with his white male listeners. But the Jews and their bedwetting liberal fellow travelers find him much less entertaining, and he has been thrown off several stations as a consequence of Jewish threats against his sponsors. Despite this Jewish hostility directed at him, and despite his frequent ridicule of blacks, he always has been favorable in his remarks about Jews, perhaps because he knows who owns most of the radio stations, or perhaps because he just doesn't understand what Jews are all about and admires their success and the power they wield over his own profession. His attitude may be changing for the better now, however. Despite my reputation as being no friend of the Jews, Bob Grant was quite cordial toward me. The hour I was his guest was the afternoon rush hour for New York commuters, and there were many calls from listeners. I'm pleased to report that at least three-quarters of the callers were favorable to my positions on race and on Jews. The few Jewish callers, of course, were intensely hostile, and their hostility made a noticeable contrast with the friendliness of the non-Jewish callers. One Jew who called in wanted to know why I blamed the Jews for the bias of the news and entertainment media. "It's not the Jews who should be blamed," he said, "but the shareholders of the media companies. The Jewish media bosses just do what the shareholders tell them to do." Well, I responded by pointing out that the top Jewish media bosses also, in many cases, are the dominant shareholders in the media companies. And I gave Sumner Redstone as an example. Redstone is the majority shareholder in his Viacom corporation, which in turn owns MTV, Paramount Pictures, and CBS. I described MTV as being the most destructive of all media influences on young white Americans. I said that MTV deliberately and consistently encourages miscegenation. I said that this racially destructive policy is Sumner Redstone's policy, not that of any anonymous shareholders, that it is a Jewish policy, and that it is the same policy as that of every other Jewish media boss. I was prepared to go on and talk about Michael Eisner and the Disney Company and ABC, and about Miramax and the Weinstein brothers, and about a lot of others. But Bob Grant disconnected that particular Jewish caller. Then Bob Grant said to me, "I don't understand. You said that Sumner Redstone and the other Jewish media bosses are deliberately trying to destroy our society. Why would they want to do that? They are rich and powerful and influential. This society has been good to them. Why would they want to destroy it? That doesn't make sense to me." That was the question he asked me, and it was a very reasonable question. It was the question that almost any intelligent, honest person might ask in those circumstances. It was the natural question to ask. Why do the Jews want to destroy a society which has been so good to them, especially the richest and most powerful Jews? One can imagine some embittered Jewish cab driver or office clerk wanting to strike out at Gentile society because he is resentful over the fact that he can't seem to strike it rich like the more fortunate members of his tribe. But why would those who are riding high, billionaire Jews such as Sumner Redstone and Michael Eisner, want to wreck the system from which they are profiting? When Bob Grant asked me that question, I wished he hadn't. I knew the answer, and it is a simple answer. But it's not the sort of answer one wants to give to people who are driving home through rush hour traffic. It is simple, but it also is profound. One needs to hear the answer and then to think about it carefully for a month, turning it over in one's mind, thinking of specific examples, trying to find counterexamples, holding it up to the light of one's knowledge of history, before one finally says to oneself, "Yes, that's it. That obviously is why the Jews do what they do and always have done." It takes a month of digesting the answer before one finally assimilates it and believes it and understands it. Rush hour traffic is not the right environment for that sort of thing. The answer, in its simplest form, to Bob Grant's question is this. Jews do what they do because they are Jews. A more didactic answer, and the one I actually gave on the Bob Grant Show last week, is one you probably have heard from me already if you've been listening to many of my broadcasts. Here's what I said to Bob Grant. The Jews, through their entire recorded history, have lived as a minority among other people. That's their typical modus vivendi, not living among themselves in a Jewish society, but living as a small minority, usually a rich and powerful minority, in a non-Jewish society. Israel today is an exception to this pattern, but Israel is an anomaly, something which has existed for only 50 years out of the last 2,000 years. And even today, it encompasses only a small minority of the world's Jews. Most of them live in the so-called diaspora as members of a Jewish minority in the midst of a Gentile society. When the Jews approach a healthy, homogeneous Gentile society with the aim of infiltrating it, they are looked upon as outsiders, as aliens, and regarded with suspicion, and often with hostility if their reputation has preceded them. Facing such suspicion, the Jews find it very difficult to gain power or influence so that they can exploit the society. Their way of dealing with this obstacle is to undermine the solidarity of the Gentile society, to destroy its homogeneity, to attack its morality and its traditions, to encourage alienation among its young people. They do everything they can to make the society more diverse, more multicultural, more cosmopolitan, more rootless, more atomized. This is a slow process, often continuing for several generations. But as it proceeds, the society's barriers against the Jews crumble. Ultimately, it allows the Jews to control and then plunder the society, to suck it dry before moving on to another Gentile society and beginning a similar process anew. That's essentially what I said on the Bob Grant Show last week, although I'm sure that the phrasing I used was a little different. And as I said a moment ago, even though my answer is simple and straightforward, it's not likely to be fully digested by someone listening to his car radio while trying to get home in rush hour traffic. It's a statement of fact, but it needs to be substantiated with a lot of detailed explanation, with many concrete examples in order to be convincing. What I'll do now is try to provide some of the explanation and some of the concrete examples. First, let's look at what I said about the Jews being a tribe of perpetual outsiders. This is a notion many people who look only at the here and now have difficulty believing. They say to me, "Hey, the Jews aren't outsiders. They're as thoroughly integrated into the American melting pot as anyone. They are in every facet of American business and professional and cultural and political life. They own stores of every sort. They buy and sell every type of merchandise. They may not be farmers or welders or machinists or carpenters, but they are doctors and dentists and lawyers and teachers and writers and artists and musicians. They are politicians. There are 10 of them in the U.S. Senate, 4 times as many as one would expect from their percentage of the overall population. There are even 2 of them on the Supreme Court, which is about 9 times what one would expect, since they make up only 2.5% of the general population. So how can you call them outsiders? That's the sort of response I've sometimes had from people who are able to see only the present situation. The historical record, however, shows something quite different. It shows the Jews worming their way into one country in Europe after another, gradually monopolizing certain sectors of the economy, and then using their monopoly to exploit the Gentile population, and eventually being expelled en masse when their depredations cause sufficient public unrest. An example is England. The Jews entered England in the wake of the Norman conquest, purchased various privileges and trade monopolies from the ruling monarchs, and made themselves thoroughly unpopular. By the latter part of the 13th century, the people of England had become so exasperated with the Jews that in 1290, King Edward the Great expelled all of them from his realm and forbade them ever to return. One might think that they wouldn't want to go back to a place where they had become so unpopular, but they couldn't stand the idea of all those Gentiles going unfleeced. And they never stopped scheming to get back in. It wasn't until Oliver Cromwell and his forces had overthrown the monarchy in the middle of the 17th century, however, that they were permitted to return to England. They also were run out of virtually every other country in Europe, several times from some of them. But they always were looking for opportunities to sneak back in and return to their old depredations. They especially welcomed the upheavals and dislocations accompanying wars and revolutions, because these gave them opportunities to gain footholds in places from which public hostility or the law had excluded them. During the Napoleonic Wars, at the beginning of the 19th century, Jews followed Napoleon's armies into many places from which they previously had been barred. Usually, they didn't have to wait for a war, however. Typically, they would depend upon the natural tolerance of their hosts to get a toe in the door, and then they would work slowly and patiently to push that tolerance beyond all limits. They always have had an uncanny instinct for sniffing out their hosts' natural weaknesses and vices, and then using them to break down the society's discipline and order, thereby making it possible for them to enlarge their toehold and gain more influence. Thus, the Jews always have had a proclivity for the liquor business, casinos and other gambling activity, prostitution, the white slave trade, pornography, and the like. It is no coincidence that for many years, the Jewish Baughman family have owned the company which is the biggest producer and distributor of liquor in North America, the Seagram Company. There are many non-Jews involved in the hotel business around the country, but in Las Vegas, where gambling is so intimately associated with hotels, the business is completely dominated by Jews. In the booming new business of internet pornography, the biggest operator, the so-called Bill Gates of e-porn, is a nice Jewish boy named Seth Warshawski, who owns ClubLove.com and many other of the largest pornography sites. And so it goes. They find their way to whatever corrupts and weakens their hosts, to whatever is morally destructive, to whatever makes their hosts forget their own traditions and values. They attack order and discipline. Those things are no fun. Those things are old-fashioned. Those things are not cool, they tell the young people. They ridicule the concepts of personal honor and personal responsibility. They distract the people from the important things and fill their minds with foolishness. They encourage every tendency which is alienating, every tendency which separates people from their roots. They preach tolerance as the supreme virtue. Their hosts should be tolerant of every sort of filth and weakness and perversity. And all the while, they worm their way into the host society more and more deeply. And indeed, in America today, they are in very, very deep. At the beginning of the last century, there were signs in the lobbies of New York's better hotels, "Jews are not welcome." The better universities had quotas to keep the Jewish presence from becoming too obtrusive. The Jews were pushy, unpleasant outsiders, but they kept on pushing, kept on breaking down the order and structure in the society which was trying in a very feeble and excessively civilized way to keep them out. And today, no less pushy and unpleasant than a century ago, they seem to have achieved the status of insiders everywhere. And so one might ask, as Bob Grant did, why, having become privileged insiders, are they still bent on destroying our society? Why do even the richest and most powerful Jews, Jews such as Sumner Redstone and Michael Eisner, who have access to everything in our society they want, still work day and night to corrupt and degrade us? Why, having wormed their way in, do all of them push for increasing the flood of non-whites into the United States from the third world, thereby weakening their own position? Why do they still encourage our young girls to have sex with blacks, thereby generating hatred against themselves? Why, having gotten so much of our wealth and power into their hands, don't they strive to strengthen our society instead of continuing to destroy it? Well, there are several reasons for that. But let me again give you the simplest answer, which also is the most profound answer. Jews do what they do because they are Jews. Do you remember the fable about the scorpion and the frog? The scorpion wants to cross a stream, but he can't swim. He sees a frog and asks the frog to carry him across on the frog's back. The frog says, "No, I don't trust you. I've heard about how treacherous scorpions are. I'm afraid that if I let you get on my back, you'll sting me." The scorpion replies, "Why should I do that? That wouldn't be in my interest. If I sting you, then we'll both drown." So the frog agrees to let the scorpion get on his back and begins swimming across the stream. Halfway across, the scorpion stings the frog. As the frog is dying and beginning to sink, he asks, "Why did you do that? Now we'll both die." The scorpion answers, "I couldn't help myself. It is in my nature to sting. And it is in the nature of the Jews to deceive and to destroy. That is what they always have done from the days of ancient Egypt to the present. And it is what they will continue to do as long as they continue to exist as a coherent, self-conscious group." Now, there also are longer answers to the question for those who aren't ready yet to accept the profound answer. Many ethnic groups came to America from Europe and at first were considered as outsiders, but sooner or later became insiders, and the interests of the majority became their interests. In a sense, every group that didn't come here from Great Britain began as outsiders. The German mercenaries from Hessen, who fought for King George and stayed here after the American Revolution, very quickly became insiders. The Irish, The Poles and the Italians all went through a similar evolution. Why is it so different with the Jews, aside from the fact that their roots are not European, but are Middle Eastern? For one thing, these other groups, the non-Jewish groups, never had deceit and destruction as their primary tactics for becoming insiders. These tactics are not part of their history. Their aim was to become part of the society, not to break it up so that they could exploit it more easily. This difference is manifested in the difference in self-image between non-Jews and Jews. Every healthy ethnic or racial group has a distinct sense of group identity and a distinct self-image. The Scots and the English, for example, have distinct self-images with their own distinct ancestral languages, their own historical traditions and customs, and so on. But despite their history of conflict and hostility toward one another in Europe, either group can blend into the other and adopt the other's interests without difficulty. The Jews are different in both degree and kind. For one thing, they are much more strongly ethnocentric than any other group. Look in the yellow pages under the heading Associations in any large American city. Compare the number of Jewish associations or clubs or societies or organizations with those of the Irish or the Germans or the Poles. Of course, you also must have some idea of what percentage of the city's population is Jewish or Irish or whatever in order to get a meaningful comparison. For the best statistics, go to a library which has a copy of the Encyclopedia of Associations. Jews make up just 2.5% of the population of the United States, and yet you will find more Jewish associations listed than for any other ethnic or religious group. They do stick together and support each other more than the members of any other group. The Jews also are different in kind. What is the essential element in being a Jew? It is being chosen. It is believing that one is a member of a tribe or a race or a people that has been chosen by their tribal God to inherit the earth and all that's in it. It is being superior to all who have not been chosen. If you are able to read the Old Testament with an open mind, the message there is quite clear. If you want more detail, read their Talmud. They don't like for you to go poking around in their Talmud, but if you are reasonably resourceful, you can find a set of volumes of the Talmud and read what they think about themselves in contrast to non-Jews. If that's too much trouble for you, there are other books available. Books written by race-conscious Jews themselves, which spell it out for you. My sponsor, National Vanguard Books, carries several such books. The book, You Gentiles, by the Jewish leader, Maurice Samuel, is excellent for a start. Then there are the very revealing books on the doctrines and practice of Judaism by Israeli professor Israel Shehak. And there are dozens of other books, many of them written by Jews themselves, that can help you in digesting and assimilating what I told Bob Grant last week. But most fundamentally, the Jew, like the scorpion and every other creature, does what it is in his nature to do. He has always lived not by settling down on a piece of turf of his own and planting his own crops and building his own house, but rather by breaking into someone else's house. And once in, he doesn't try to repair the damage he did by breaking in, but he continues to cause more and more damage as he loots everything of value, and then when there is nothing of value remaining, finding another house to break into, and then another, and another. That is his nature. And I should add, there is hardly a more important thing for any of us to do now than understand why the Jews are pushing our society over the brink of ruin, and then to oppose them by every means possible. Thanks for being with me again today.